Hello, and welcome to Voices from the SBS Summit, brought to you by the National Insider Threat Task Force. I'm Dr. Kristen Schneider, and I'm a licensed clinical psychologist and behavioral research scientist with the Threat Lab. Today, Dr. Nicole Alford and I are continuing the conversation we started back in September during the Counter Insider Threat Social and Behavioral Sciences Summit. Hi, Nicole. How have you been since the summit?
I am well, Kristen. Hello.
I'm so glad to hear it. I hope that all of our listeners have watched the recording of your webcast, which is available on sbssummit.com. But for those who haven't, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do? I understand that you have an exciting new position.
I do. So after 22 years of federal government service, either as a full-time employee or a contractor, I resigned my position as a consultant to a federal agency about 2 weeks ago, and I'm excited to announce that I will be an insider threat lead with Meta. You all know Meta as Facebook, more commonly. And so again, I'm an insider threat professional. I will be standing up an insider threat program there. My roots are in national security in the intelligence community. I'm a former covert CIA officer and spent a number of years traveling the world and just really supporting and being rooted in operations and intelligence collection and just helping to secure our great nation. I know as many of us do.
You have a really, really interesting background. Perfect person for us to talk to as part of this podcast and part of this summit. We're definitely looking forward to seeing what comes next from you and your work with Meta. In your summit presentation, you talked about the diversification of the U.S. workforce and the importance of creating inclusive environments. You also talked about the intersection between cultural sensitivity, cultural awareness, diversity, and inclusivity. So let's pick up where we left off, and let me ask you, from a counter-insider threat perspective, why is it so important to address and promote inclusivity within organizations?
You know, I think certainly we all want employees that not only feel valued, but that really feel a part of a mission and really a part of an organization. We are very fortunate to be working in a day and in a time when bringing one's whole self into work and into the workplace or the virtual workspace is not only the expectation, but it really is the desire by employees. And I've found, Kristen, just from a psychological perspective, that when people don't feel that they can be their authentic, genuine, and whole selves, when people feel that they have to compartmentalize pieces or aspects of who they are, that doesn't really lend itself to making a happy or a maximally and optimally productive employee. And so we really want to create environments where people really feel that they belong, where they feel wedded to the mission and really an integral part of that mission. That makes for a high job satisfaction and a satisfied employee.
Yeah, you're right. It really does. You've also talked about what happens when that is not the case, right? When lack of diversity or failure to create an inclusive environment can actually lead to people feeling discriminated against, routinely microaggressed against, and that can lead to disgruntlement, which is really a key precursor to insider threat. I think it's such a really important point and something that's often overlooked. What are some of the reasons that you've seen why organizations fail to create that diverse and inclusive environment that could really actually protect the organization?
You know, that's a great question. So first, let me say, I am of the opinion that when people, to include organizations, right, and companies, when they know better, they'll do better. So I certainly don't think any organization or company or agency sets out to say, you know, we're just going to be a monolith. We're just going to be one thing and we don't want diversity. Rather, Kristen, I think that senior leaders and companies and organizations know that they are being expected to and need to be diverse. They simply don't know how. So I would say that is the number one impediment. I think number two, unfortunately, diversity, equity, inclusion, whatever word du jour that we can come up with that we use commonly to describe the phenomenon of just having different ideas, different generations, different ethnicities, religions, sexual orientations, different abilities, etc., right? Whatever word we use to describe that, I think those words conjure up feelings of angst and anxiety for many people. it causes us to have to think about ourselves. It causes us to have to examine our own values and belief systems and perhaps how we think about people who are other than we. It causes us to maybe have to challenge some of those values, maybe even some of the values that we were socialized into and brought up believing. And so it can be a little uncomfortable for some people. It can cause anxiety. And so I think that's number two. Number three, I will say that many companies and agencies have attempted and have tried to be quite intentional about diversification and about inclusion. But I think simply their efforts have fallen short because the attempts that they made were maybe not the right ones. I think also, in order to be able to do this work, I think you probably need representation at the table, right? So I think oftentimes we've had efforts that were created and implemented by people who maybe didn't have the 360-degree panoramic vision because maybe perhaps they were an other. Right? Maybe they were part of sort of the dominant culture. And so they attempted to implement what they thought would be a good idea, what would create an inclusive environment and help people feel welcome. But maybe those efforts just fell a little short. So I would say those three reasons are the ones that really are primarily why we have some difficulties in this area.
Those are, I think, a really, really great, it gives us really good coverage on a lot of the different reasons. I mean, you're right. Sometimes people have the goal of increasing diversity, increasing inclusion, and they really just don't know how to operationalize that. Other times they have really good intentions and these efforts fall short. And I think your point about folks needing to be represented at the table in order to really strategize these things, to understand first from a perspective of what is it that really needs to change? You've got to have the right people at the table to even be able to answer that first question. In your summit presentation, you actually proposed a review and change process that organizations can follow in order to increase their diversity and inclusion. From what I recall, the process was four steps. The first one being recognize the need and commit to change. Second being start at the top. Third being evaluate where you are. And the fourth being measure your success. I really loved this evidence-based approach. As a psychologist who works with organizations as well as with individuals, I'm really struck by how similar these steps for enacting change are, really whether we're talking about the individual level or the organizational level. In your talk, you highlighted that importance of sitting with the discomfort that comes up when we identify a needed change that hasn't been made. Can you tell us a little bit more about why that step is so critical and why it's so often met with resistance?
Yeah, so, you know, Kristen, you and I, we share a commonality and we're both psychologists. And of course, it's very difficult to sort of divorce how I think and how I view and conceptualize issues, right? That's the schema sort of that I use. And so I think you're right. It probably does sound a little bit psychological in terms of trying to understand the process of change. And certainly it is very similar to what we see in clients or patients that we may treat therapeutically. And you'll probably agree with this, Kristen, in order to facilitate and foster change, there must be some discomfort. There has to be. Oftentimes, the discomfort psychologically and behaviorally is what will fuel the change, right? And so, again, I think that discomfort really is anxiety, right? I think that's just really the psychological sort of label or construct we can use to best describe it. It's anxiety. And that anxiety has many different roots, right? One root perhaps is that, well, darn it, we have to change, right? And so folks or leaders may begrudge that a bit because change is hard individually and, of course, even more so likely organizationally. I think another root of the anxiety could be, again, it forces us to look at ourselves and our own issues, as it should, because organizations are made up of people, right? They're made up of humans, and we all bring our own stuff, our own baggage, our own values and mores and socialization and philosophies and just sort of how we view and interact with the world. We bring all of that into the workplace. And so it forces us to do a very uncomfortable thing, which is to look at ourselves and our own stuff. I think thirdly, it forces us and it really challenges us to have uncomfortable conversation. I think about sometimes in working with teams or leading a team when we've had to have very uncomfortable conversations and difficult conversations, and it certainly forces us to do that. So really what I say then is we acknowledge the discomfort, we acknowledge that we're going to feel that, and then maybe what the smart thing to do is to lean into it, not to run away from it, but to lean into it. How can we leverage this discomfort, right? What is this discomfort really about and why do I feel it? And if I feel it as a senior leader, right, who is self-aware, who certainly has been trained to be fair and unbiased in how I evaluate and interact with people that I manage or supervise or in the workforce, right? I've had a sort of a lot of training with that. And I certainly am the agent and the representation of the organization. If that's how I feel, then certainly the entire workforce, right? Many people may be struggling with the same feeling. So I would say, Kristen, we acknowledge it, but we also lean into it, because I think to do the opposite, to do the antithesis of that, is simply going to keep us sort of stuck in this place of unchange.
I think you're so right about that. And there really is a strong link here between individual change and organizational change, which, as you rightly suggest, is really just about larger numbers of people and the way that they interact with each other. You know, with treatment of anxiety disorders, what we're always looking for is where is the person avoiding, right? So within an organization, you can certainly imagine that if you are at this first step of recognize the need and commit to change, but perhaps you're in a situation where, like you described before, one of the problems that organizations run into is that they recognize this need, but they don't know how. They don't know how to change. They don't know exactly what is needed. It would be really easy to fall into avoidance as a result of that anxiety. But just like with individuals, the organizations can identify that anxiety, that discomfort, as a place to step in. I think that's exactly right. There's also this piece that, you know, sometimes I think we need to really broaden what we think of when we think of diversity and inclusion. Just when we talk about cultural diversity, people tend to immediately think of factors like race, ethnicity, religion, gender, sexuality. But there's actually a lot more to it. Cultural diversity can actually be much broader, can't it? You know, you and I have recently had some conversations about these sort of new and different factors of cultural diversity that organizations are having to wrestle with. What are some of the other examples that you can think of? Things that organizations should be thinking about when they're at this step of evaluating where they are?
Yeah. So, you know, I think certainly the current events of today's times, and when I say today, I'm, you know, I mean the past couple of years, certainly, you know, maybe even the past few years, probably 3 years, maybe even four. I think we have all been faced with the idea that diversity is not just those physical attributes that we can see or that we think we can see, right? And sort of categorize and classify and label people using those. But certainly, how about a person's ideology or philosophy or beliefs? So for example, one of the things that the federal organization that I just recently left was dealing with, as many organizations were and still are political differences and just how divisive and how heated those can be. And really, those can actually have a nexus to insider threat behaviors. How about another example, Kristen, vaccines, whether or not a person is vaccinated and or why, right? Because arguably the person who has chosen not to become vaccinated because of they have medical issues, so perhaps they can obtain a medical waiver, that person is very different, perhaps, from the person who on religious, right, basis decides not to become vaccinated or mask wearing. And so I think there are a number of challenges that we're facing in today's time that really, those challenges really are forcing us to broaden our definition of cultural diversity, what that means, how we define it, and what we do with that. Right. And then how do we take those differences and bring people together in a workplace in a way that is tolerable for all, that is equitable for all, where no one feels left out, where everyone feels like there's a place for me here? That indeed is a challenge. And again, many organizations are really struggling with that right now.
Oh, you're so right about that. I love these examples too, because I think they really help our listeners to really think about how some of these things play out in their day-to-day lives throughout organizations. I mean, what organization, government, private sector, whatever, who isn't dealing with this issue of figuring out vaccine status, masking, some of these things that are really fairly new issues on the face of them, perhaps, but really have to do with this underlying question of the fact that people think about things differently. And you mentioned ideology, that people have different ideologies and that they're sometimes fairly complex. I mean, you can't tell by looking at someone wearing a mask or not wearing a mask, what their underlying ideology is, right? You might have some guesses, but you also mentioned political divisiveness. This is one that I see as a really potent challenge. I think there's been, you know, political divisiveness is not a new thing, but there's been perhaps an exacerbation of some of the, perhaps some increased heat to some of these topics. And I don't know, have you seen within sort of American culture more broadly, would you say that there is perhaps more difficulty in understanding, accepting, appreciating people's divergent political beliefs? I can imagine that is something that people bring into organizations, even if it's not a political organization, that folks have to regularly interact with others who have very different political beliefs from each other. And that's part of the diversity that organizations have to contend with and really work on.
You know, I totally agree. I think there's always been, obviously, different politics, right? And political beliefs and different ideologies and people who belong to different, you know, parties, perhaps. But I think certainly there's a broader, much wider societal problem. And of course, you know, organizations are simply microcosms of society. And so what affects society writ large absolutely impacts and affects how organizations function, the people within those organizations, the zeitgeist of those organizations, the climate of those organizations. And so I think to the extent that things have become really very quite hot and divisive and the rhetoric, you know, there is no civility or very little of it left.
Yes.
Ever. Again, because organizations mirror society, we see that happening in the workplace. There's one federal agency that I'm aware of. I do not work for that agency, but I am aware that there is at least one federal agency in the IC that put out a communique to all that basically said, you as an employee or contractor in the limits of this building cannot have discussions. You must not, and this was put out right before the last election, you must not have any political discussions in the building. If it's brought to management's attention, you can face a reprimand. And they put that out because they obviously felt that things could get so, because things had gotten so heated, right? And so obviously there have been some issues there. But I think that we're certainly at a time where, you know, I'm old enough to remember there were two things you never discussed at work. And I remember my parents, when I was just a teenager and beginning to enter the workforce, they said, you don't ever talk about religion and you don't ever talk about politics at work. But now, right? I mean, cultural times are changing, culture is changing. And so, yeah, it's a whole different time.
Yeah, you're so right about that. You talked about that, the lack of civility too. And I think that's where I've seen a real change, right? Is people have always had strong political opinions. But I think there's been something new in the, not just political discussions becoming heated, but just a general attitude of, you know, the people on the other side are idiots. They don't have a valid perspective. And I think that's something that's changed and is something that organizations have to be very cautious about managing, because this can get applied across the board, right? If you don't see the person who has a different perspective from you as having a right to their perspective and perhaps having some valid points or valid needs, it starts us from a place where we have to begin by saying, you know, there are certain things that we can't talk about within the workplace. It's sort of a blunt instrument. I wonder if there are more refined approaches for how do organizations, recognizing that there are a wide variety of opinions and belief structures in their employees, within their organizations, how do we get back to this place of encouraging people to be curious about other people's backgrounds and perspectives, and to not just sort of instinctually reject them, particularly out of this anxiety, this sense of feeling threatened by somebody else's differences or their different perspective. It seems to me that that's a pretty key place to really begin, understanding that there are going to be lots of important differences in the way that people see things.
And I think the other thing is we have to not dehumanize people. I think there's a fair amount of objectification and dehumanization of people. And so people are no longer humans, right? Who may look differently and who may think differently than I do, but they're still humans. I think that has fallen by the wayside. And I think now we simply focus on the thought, the idea, the philosophy, the belief, the slogan, the t-shirt, the hat. We simply focus on the object, the part of the human, so that the person is no longer human anymore. Certainly, we know, Kristen, you and I, as psychologists, very unfortunately, when you dehumanize people like that and they become parts and not wholes, they become objects and things and not people, it certainly becomes easier to aggress against them verbally, to think that they don't belong, to view them as very different and not having a right to be here. It makes it very easy to behave against that individual in very nefarious and negative ways. And so I think we have to first start by, again, you know, I'm big on things trickling from the top down. I think we have to first be very mindful, our senior leaders do, about how we categorize and classify and communicate and speak about people. So for example, is it wise to refer to people as vaccinated versus unvaccinated? I just don't know how helpful that really is in the grand scheme of things. What it does is it forms two groups of people who really are serving the same mission, some of whom may have a really very valid reason for not being vaccinated. They decided to make a choice. And are they a bad person or a bad employee just because they didn't choose the way you choose? No, I don't know. And so I just think it has to start from the top. I'm just really big on how leadership sets the tone for all things in an organization.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you have such a great point too about the labeling of people, right? When we break people into groups and apply a label, it does really serve to dehumanize. You know, it makes me think, what do we do with that? You know, the reverse of that is really to humanize people, to understand people on an individual level, even if we're talking about within a really large organization and large groups of people. I think it suggests that there's something really key about understanding, coming back to this idea of understanding the whole person, understanding people as individuals who are really complex. I mean, you could take someone and group them in any number of ways, and that really doesn't get at the entirety of that person, you know, no matter what kind of grouping you're using. It's an interesting thought about how do we really get people to embrace change. Part of it is we've got to start by humanizing each other, right? To really understand and appreciate the complex person and not just the one particular choice or one particular idea that they might hold in one area.
Absolutely. And that has to be number one. You're right. And then number two, after we've humanized the person and we see him or her, they as a human, and as a whole person, well, then we want to view that person in a context, right? We want to view that whole person within the context of which he or she exists and lives and breathes and thinks and really is. And I think that's just really quite helpful. It is an approach, and certainly an insider threat approach, that is consistent with, you know, there is no one size fits all in terms of mitigating risk or even individual risk, but we have to look at that human being, that person, as a whole person and within the context.
Such an important point too. The context is really everything. It really helps you to understand how the person is operating and in many cases, why they're doing the things that they're doing. I'm wondering also, you know, as organizations are making changes to the composition, the structure, their goals or their methods, really in order to improve diversity and inclusion, I know a lot of times that can really be met with some of that resistance that we talked about, resistance to change, particularly from people who are really accustomed to the old ways of doing things, particularly people who already felt that they were included, who don't necessarily recognize that there is a need for change, people who traditionally benefited from dominant paradigms. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on some of the ways that organizations can help those type of folks to accept and maybe even embrace change instead of viewing it as a threat?
You know, I said a few minutes ago that diversity and all of the other words that are synonymous with diversity, they've really gotten a bad rap, right? Because they conjure up certain thoughts, images, ideas, emotions, and feelings in people. And those emotions and thoughts and feelings in people are going to, of course, differ depending upon the whole person within his or her context and his or her socialization and upbringing and entire phenomenology. But I think what we must do, particularly those of us who happen to work in DEI, in diversity, equity, and inclusion, and I don't work in that field, but I know some about it. I think what we have to do is we have to start touting what are the merits of diversity, right?
Yeah.
And why should organizations be diverse, right? And of course we should be diverse, yeah, because it's in keeping with the requirements of the law. It's a good thing to do. It's the fair and just and equitable thing. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of reasons that we have to. But how about let's start touting some of the business bottom line merits of it, right? Let's start touting the fact that when we have diversity, as we traditionally think of it, we have diversity of ideas. We have diversity of experiences. If we have a diversity of generations, right, we are a 360-degree organization, and we have a whole bunch of different optics and perspectives, and that's only going to make us better. It's only going to make us more creative. It's only going to make us more agile. It's only going to make us more mission effective. I think diversity has just really, really, Kristen, it's gotten a bad rap. I think we focus too much on just sort of the legal aspects of it, those traditional ways of thinking of it, and not really just sort of the consequences of it, the positive consequences of it. I think we don't focus on that enough. And I think if we begin to do that, I do think that people who say, you know, I don't really see a need for us having to hire more people who look differently or who think differently or who, you know, who worship differently. I think we're a pretty equitable and fair society. Maybe if they don't see it in that perspective, then they'll see how it could help the bottom line. So I just think we have to just be a little broader in how we market diversity. And I do think we need to market it. It's clear that there has to be a concerted effort to sort of market the need for diversity, unfortunately.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, what you're describing is really a shift in thinking from thinking of diversity and inclusion as something that one should do, perhaps for legal reasons or some abstract reason because it's the right thing to do, and really shifting to thinking about it as something that an organization should really want to do, that it actually really offers tremendous advantages for the organization. It does so many positive things. And I think you're right, to help people, particularly people who have been in an organization for a long time, are comfortable, right? Who don't necessarily want to step into the discomfort of change, to help people understand what the advantages of doing that are. And how diversity and inclusion, how those changes can really benefit not just the organization as a whole, but all of the individuals within the organization. I think you're right. It really has to come from helping people to see that this is really a huge advantage, not a negative, and certainly not just a neutral, but something that creates positive advantages for everyone. It's really the key to getting people to not just to assess where they are, but to be willing to move beyond that, to be able to make important changes.
Absolutely. We need everyone to buy into it. And in order to gain buy-in, particularly for those people who don't see a need for it, right, we have to meet them where they are, and we almost have to convince them. It's like, you know, with any other significant change or significant, ideological shift and behavioral shift that we needed to make in our nation's history, we had to market and literally make it cool and make it acceptable and convince people because of that. You know, I think back, for example, to campaigns where, for example, Rosie the Riveter, we had to make it cool for women to enter the workforce and to help the wartime effort. We had to make it cool. And there were posters and there were slogans and there were songs and little jingles. And it was a very intentional and concerted marketing effort to sell something to gain buy-in. And so I think this perhaps might be where we are with this. There are many people who, Kristen, as you said, don't feel comfortable. They feel that diversity, if we increase diversity, it somehow means there's no place for me and for people who look like me.
Right.
I know this because I had a colleague who said this, who said, I don't feel like this is a department where someone who looks like me can get a fair shot. I don't feel like I'm going to get a promotion if I go up against someone like you.
Right.
And so we have to just deal with the reality of it, but we have to sell the merits of diversity.
You're so right. And doing this in a way where you're not forcing change on people, you're engaging them and getting them invested in these changes. Otherwise, you risk creating a new set of grievances, don't you?
You risk creating disgruntlement. You risk creating insider threats. And of course, you know, as we know, insider threats are rare. Not everyone is going to enact some type of a hostile act against an organization that they feel has grieved them. But even attrition at a significant enough rate can be a mission threat, right? So we don't want folks to leave because they don't feel that they belong and they don't feel that there's a place here for them anymore. So these are all mission threats that we want to be very intentional and guard against. Absolutely.
Such important points. I think we could probably talk for many hours on this topic, but I think that that's going to be where we're going to leave it for today. But I look forward to more conversations with you. Thank you all for listening, and a big thank you to our speaker, Dr. Nicole Alford. As I mentioned at the beginning, to listen to Dr. Alford's summit presentation, please visit sbssummit.com. Also, don't miss out on new products from the Threat Lab. Sign up for our distribution list at dodhra.threatlab@mail.mil.